Jeg blev fyret og fik hjælp lige med det samme.
Da min arbejdsgiver gik konkurs, fik jeg et rentefrit lån.
Da jeg skulle i flexjob, stod de virkelig klar.
Jeg fik endelig mine feriepenge, takket være Det Faglige Hus.
Uanset hvor du står i dit arbejdsliv, står vi bag dig. Det Faglige Hus. Danmarks billigste fagforening med A-kasse for alle.
MyRock Podcast tager dig med backstage.
Velkommen til denne episode af MyRock Podcast. Mit navn er Sten Skovgaard, og i denne omgang, der kan du møde Sultan Bathory. Han er guitarist i Five Finger Death Punch. De har lige været i Danmark, spillet en koncert i Royal Arena med support fra Bad Wolves og Megadeth. Og netop Bad Wolves kommer vi faktisk til at tale om i den her podcast, fordi hvem er manager for Bad Wolves? Ingen andre end Sultan Bathory. Vi kommer også til at snakke om Five Finger Death Punch, om deres trommeslager Jeremy Spencer, som stoppede for at blive politimand, om hvordan det er at få en ny trommeslager med i bandet. Vi kommer til at snakke om, hvordan det påvirker et bands dynamik, når forsangeren og bassisten lige pludselig bliver ædru. Sultan kommer også til at fortælle om, hvordan det er at frygte, at bandet går i opløsning fra den ene dag til den anden. Med andre ord, det der med at stoppe om morgenen og ikke vide, om man har et arbejde eller ej. Vi kommer til at tale om workflowet, for hvordan skriver man egentlig en sang til Five Finger Death Punch? Og så kommer vi heller ikke udenom, at Five Finger Death Punch er et band, som polariserer rigtig meget. Der er rigtig mange, der elsker dem, og der er rigtig mange, som ikke kan udstå dem. Men det har Sultan lært at affinde sig med. Du kommer til at høre om fremtidsplanerne for bandet, om at de gerne vil indtage Japan, de vil gerne turnere rigtig meget, og så vil de også gerne lave nogle videoer til det nye album, som hedder Fate. Med andre ord, det her bliver temmelig omfattende. Så sæt dig godt til rette og lyt med. Det her er My Rock Podcast med Five Finger Death Punch.
I spoke to God today, and she said that she's ashamed. What have I become? What have I done? I spoke to the devil today, and he swears he's not to blame. And I understood, 'cause I feel the same.
I'm here with the Sultan of Five Finger Death Punch. How are you?
Very good, very good.
And welcome to Denmark.
Can't complain. And, you know, thanks for having us. It's a well, good night tonight.
You've actually been here quite a few times.
Yes.
And you actually also played here in Royal Arena. What do you think of Denmark?
Well, you know, first and foremost, when we came here the first time, we had about 150, 170 people in a small club. And looking at this arena sold out today, holy cow. It's amazing. And what do you mean? Like, this is the land of the Vikings, man. It's like, actually, I did a, you know, like the genetic, you know, like you can do the genetic.
Yeah, the heritage stuff.
Yeah, heritage stuff. Yeah. And I did mine. And so apparently I'm from here somewhere.
You are?
Yeah. So, wow. So I did my, you know, genetic research and I'm like, I'm 48% Viking. I'm like, all right. Well, you know, explains a lot though. Yeah, I have to talk to my grandma too. Like, you know, hey, grandma, let's talk about this. Where were you really?
What were you doing?
Yeah, right.
So actually, I want to talk to you about the support bands because I just witnessed Bad Wolves. Mm-hmm. Those guys are the most gutsy guys I've ever seen. 10 minutes into their set, they're doing a mosh pit.
Right.
Have you ever seen anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, we did that.
But, that's crazy.
I mean, you know, I manage Bad Wolves, right? Yeah. So it's a band that every single member of that band was in previous bands that on one point or another we toured with. So, you know, God forbid. And I mean, like all these guys came from, you know, reputable, you know, metal bands. So they've been around the block. They've seen a thing or two, you know. And so when they formed this band, the first time I heard, you know, I heard their demos at the time, I was like, okay, I think I can help you guys. This has legs. This band can go the distance, you know. So I walked them into my record label, the record label we are signed to and management, and started to co-manage them, and you know, and then we could put them on the road with us, and you know, and help their careers. Basically, hardworking guys, you know. So they don't need much other than have to have them to avoid the landmines, you know, because we've seen it before, you know, seen this movie before. So I can say, okay, maybe don't go there, go here, don't do that, you know, and don't sign this, you know, those kind of things. But I'm really proud of them. They're doing awesome.
So what's basically the best advice that you can give to them?
To them?
Yeah.
It's
or to any other band that's
any other,
starting
you,
out.
You got to do the work. There are no shortcuts. You know what I mean? It's especially now. You know, there was a time when MTV was sort of a global, you know, global power. A band got famous and got famous through, you know, their videos were played everywhere in the world, you know. So you had a visual who they were and you heard their music. Once that was gone, you know, everything is regional. You can be huge in, let's say, Denmark and not known anywhere else, right? So this changed. So you have to do the work and there are no shortcuts. It's absolutely you know, the numbers game in some way too. You have to do the tours. You know, we were on the road for 200 days every year, you know, played everywhere we could. It's just what it is. You just have to keep going. And I know it might sound like a pretty standard advice, but, you know, but I guess it's, you know, it's still something that has to be said. And then, you know, on a different scale, there are, of course, many, many things that I can, you know, but that's why, you know, I'm helping different bands that, you know, do certain stuff. Like even things that you wouldn't think of, let's say songwriting, split it equally. Because this is what's going to happen. You do your first record and the second record, you realize your drummer or whoever didn't write any music is still broke while you're doing pretty good, right? And so what's going to happen, now your drummer or whoever is the non-writing member will want to write songs because they realize that, you know. And so then it becomes a fight. Then it becomes a thing where how many songs from who gets on the record versus have the best songs on the record, right? So if you make a deal with your band members, doesn't matter who writes, we all share. Then you end up with these songs and everybody will have the same, you know, the same goal. Have the best songs on the record versus it has to be mine so I can get, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I think those little things are very important. Because those are the things that rip bands apart. It's always keep the band together as long as you can. Sometimes there are band members that are unreasonable or you just can't work with them. But if you try to communicate, try to figure out, firing people or getting rid of people from the band is your last resort. You know, And you know, that's it.
Actually, I was thinking, because there's been a few bumps on the road for Five Finger Death Punch over the last...
Oh, more than a few.
Yeah, but that we know of.
Yeah.
I remember last time you were here, I was talking to Jeremy, and we talked about the dispute with your label at that point. You actually had recorded the album, and they wouldn't release it to you and all that stuff. And, I mean, the new album coming out in a month from now, I guess the lead up to this album have been more relaxed, more comfortable for you. So tell me, how was it to work on the new album in these conditions?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of answers to this, actually. I mean, there are different parts to this. One of the parts that Ivan is sober for 2 years now, you know, and so he's sober, Chris is sober. So you have a band that is very focused, sharp, very focused, and want to work, you know? So there is that. Like, everybody wants to go to the studio and accomplish something. And there's also something to prove, because this is the first record, let's say, for Ivan that he did completely sober and, you know, and focused. And also, when somebody gets sober, your personality kind of changes. You think differently. You behave differently. And, you know, if you look at the music is always a sum total of the band members, whoever in the band. So these are the same guys, but not really. See what I mean? Like, they are the same bodies, and it changes the dynamics, changes how we write. And I think it definitely shows on the record that this is a more focused, more energized. And, you know, and with saying that, I'm not complaining about the previous records. I love every record we did, and I thought we did a great job. And I guess it became pretty successful, so I could say that people liked it. And in an interesting way, organically, we got to this 8th record. This is about a time that you would have to change something anyway, you know. This is like, you know, people heard enough of the same kind of stuff, right? But how do you do that? Like, AC/DC will sound like AC/DC forever, because that's who they are, right? Or Iron Maiden, or Pick the Band, right? And Five Finger Death Punch sound like Five Finger Death Punch. We're not going to make a jazz record or whatever, right? So we come to this point where, okay, how do we develop? How do we evolve without changing our core, you know, sound or ideas? And how are we going to do this? And for us, it's organically happened by these guys becoming sober. Because out of a sudden, you know, you listen to this record, it is a Five Finger Death Punch album, but it's just different. Something is different. And the best part about it, like, I can't really tell what it is. And that's why when it's the energy, the focus, there's something that is just different, and for the better, you know? And so that, it's a welcome change, obviously. And the first couple of tracks that we released, we picked specifically songs that people who are hearing it can already tell, like, okay, there is something different here, you know? Mm. And I guess that was the major difference, the excitement, the, you know, that work ethic, you know, that let's go to the studio, let's do this, you know. Also, the band itself, the band members banded together better, because now we went through some stuff. You know, that bumpy road, that was a lot of freaking bumps. That was a crap tornado, really, you know. And so when you go through stuff with your friends or your band, or, you know, like, you're in the army or whatever, you have to see some battle to band together, really, you know. And that's what happened to this band. Like, the lawsuit with the record label, and then all the crazy stuff that happened sort of brought us to this point where we got closer, we got, you know, everybody understands that this band is bigger than any one of us. We all serve the band, you know, and the only way to move forward is with that attitude. And everybody realized how important the other person is for the whole. And so that's kind of brought us to this moment, like, wow. That's why we kind of called it, you know, first we weren't just going to call it Number 8. And then came the idea, like, well, if you put the F for Five Finger Death Punch, or just whatever, front of the 8, then it becomes Fate or Fate. Was it a predestined, a predestined way? Like, we were meant to be here. Was it fate, or was it the fate that we had in ourselves, that, like, we can do this, we can survive all this crazy stuff, you know? So we thought, like, that's an interesting, you know, blur enough, not so defined. You can take it many ways, you know? And I thought, but for us, you know, we look at this record, that's how we kind of, you know, saw it. Like, okay, this is a milestone. This is going to be a record in our career, even though we have 8 records. I think this is going to be a very, very important part, a very important record in the whole, as, you know, number 8, 7 before, but, you know, the number 1 was very important, obviously, because that's, you know, we came to the scene. It became really successful. So number 2 was important because we had to answer the question, was it a fluke, right? And then after that, maybe number 4, 5, we had to, you know, was a very important record. And, you know, so every record is important, but some of them are milestones. I think this is going to be a big milestone for us.
But this one is also the first without Jeremy, the yes. drummer. He and you founded the band in the beginning. Did you see that one coming? Jeremy leaving the band and actually pursuing a career as a police officer?
Yes. I mean, we, you know, obviously we sort of lived together on the road. So, you know, it was gradual. You know, it didn't happen just from one day to the other. So it was gradual. And so yes, we saw that coming. But if you ask me, like, did I see that coming years and years ago? No. You know, I didn't. But the last couple of years, you know, he had he's drumming since he was 6 years old. So that you're on a bicycle and you never got off of it, you know, since you're 6, basically. And so, it's, you know, sciatic nerves issues, you know, he had back problems. And, you know, so it started to really catch up with him, the constant, you know, that specific constant motion, you know. And so we saw it coming, but the way that this happened was actually very respectable, because, you know, he came to us like, hey guys, it's, you know, it's time for me to, you know, I can't perform the way that I should, you know, you guys deserve better. I just can't do it. He got a few surgeries, but we already knew that it's not, you know, he passed, you know, he accepted and passed that point where, you know, when he decided that he will look at other things and he wants to do other things in life. And you know what I mean? So he made his peace with himself that, you know, I drummed enough. I achieved the things I wanted to achieve. I played massive arenas and festivals to 100,000 people. So he could look at himself like, as a drummer, I accomplished pretty much everything I can as a drummer. But there are other aspirations, other things he wanted to do. And he had this, you know, some physical pain and physical issues with drumming. So he made peace with it and you know, and that was it. Now, Charlie was sort of an internet phenomenon. You know, people were following him. It's like, he's a professor. We call him, you know, Professor Charlie. He's a master degree and, you know, in drumming and percussion. And he's a real, you know, a connoisseur, you know what I mean? A real musician that is really deep into that. And so when Jeremy was exiting, he told us like, hey, there's this kid. He's already kind of famous on his own as a drummer, but I think he would be perfect for the band. He can do the, you know, the gig. And while we were on the road, and then in fact, I followed Charlie. So Jeremy mentioned, I'm like, oh, I know who you're talking about, because I knew who he was. And so we brought him out on the road, and basically he was sitting behind Jeremy for several gigs. We recorded all the videos. Jeremy ran him through exactly what happens in a set and when and why. And then, you know, in like that movie, The Rockstar, and then handed over the microphone. Here you go. In this case, the sticks. Like, here you go. It's up. You're up. You know, so that was a very respectable way that he exited, in a way that, hey, I'm gone, guys, but here's the new guy. I brought him up to speed, and the machine is, you know, can keep going.
But still, the drummer is such an integral part of the band. Yes. So how was it for you guys to have a new man behind the drums suddenly, in the whole rhythm section being torn apart?
There's, of course, a personal adjustment, right? As for drumming, there is a reason why Jeremy picked Charlie, and the reason why we also taught, because, you know, there between drummers, different every musicians, there are styles. Right. So Jeremy thought like, okay, Charlie's close enough to him. In fact, you know, sometimes people like, he sounds like Jeremy, you know? So because they're similar in many ways, you know? And So that was one of the criteria. How do you pick a drummer? Well, you pick a drummer who can completely fit in without much of a drastic change. So Charlie wasn't a stretch. He wasn't a drastic change. He perfectly fit. That's why we picked him. And in some way, you know, it brought actually a new energy. It's nothing against Jeremy, but it brought a new energy. Like, here's a kid who's very excited versus having issues and, you know, not feeling good and not being happy being on stage because he's in pain or whatever, you know. So that exited, and here's a new kid who's full of energy. So it kind of added actually something to watching him getting excited, this is new to him, you know? So it's almost like you see the world through his eyes, right? And as for technically, I mean, he's an incredible drummer. So there's nothing I can throw at Charlie that he can't do, you know? So that way it didn't change, and stylistically he was very similar to Jeremy, and was personally, you know, we made peace with this already, you know? It was a gradual thing anyway. So we made peace with, said goodbye to Jeremy, and then took Charlie with open arms and enjoying his, you know, his energy and how excited he is touring the world. You know, it's really for him that story of, you know, yesterday he was in shedding in a garage doing, you know, videos for the internet, right? And then, you know, a week later he was playing for 20,000 people. You know, that's a culture shock, but we enjoy watching that, you know. Same thing happened with Chris, you know, when we had Chris, the bass guitarist, came to us. His first show was in front of 30,000 people. Same thing, deep water, you know? Yeah. So, and it was really fun watching him becoming who he is today, you know, because he, not that he was ever shy, he wasn't. He was a really outgoing person to begin with, but still, it's, you know, it's a different environment. Out of a sudden, it's boom, you're exposed. You're on stage and 30,000 pairs of eyes.
There's no way back.
There's no way back now. You know, it's not a movie when you can, okay, cut, record it again. No, it already happened. So we went through with that with Chris, and now we're going through with Charlie. It's a good energy, you know, because he's so excited. I smile when I look at him, like he's all, you know, banging on the drums and, you know, looking around like, wow, this is happening.
Is it almost like starting over again?
Yes, but I would say in a positive way, you know, that's just life, you know, like I could paint all kind of pictures here, but let's look at the reality is that in life, sometimes you have to have those changes to move ahead, you know, and I think as crazy as that last 12 years was, you know, everything sort of got synchronized out of a sudden. Like how Chris and Ivan got sober. Then Charlie came into the picture. Then we left that old record label and we are with a new record label. All these things happened in the same time. So in some way, this was a rebirth. The band, even though we didn't really die, you know what I mean? But I can say it was some sort of the rebirth, or more like, I should use the word transcendence. This brand transcended for whatever it was. And we were very successful. But still, somehow from whatever it was, it evolved and transcended into this new thing that I'm really happy about, actually. It's I can breathe up. You know, it feels like, wow, we have another 10 years of runway where, you know, 2 years ago, every morning it was like, well, let's see what happens at 10 p.m. Do we have a band? Are we playing this show? Because you don't know what was going to happen. Every day was crazy. And that uncertainty is really wears on you. Like, I don't know what, you know. It's early in the morning. This evening, the whole thing can be on fire, you know.
I stand alone. Guess I knew it all along. Yes, I knew that you were wrong. How you left when I was down. You can leave it because
never did. So you can wipe it away, that silly fucking grin.
If I wrote it down for you, could you ever see it clear? Or would it go straight through your soul and come right out your ear? If I slowed it down for you, would you think me insincere? Cause in the end, I'll never bend, I'll never shed a tear.
There's no denying it.
Were you ever at a point where you were uncertain of Five Finger Death Punch being able to continue?
Yes, I mean, you know, there were moments where, as I said, we were always balancing on the edge and of a sword, kind of, right? And most of the crazy stuff the world didn't know. You know, this was really freaking crazy. Like the things, we were banned from 4 different airlines at one point, you know. So for us to fly somewhere, it was like, okay, how about through Timbuktu, we take a boat? And, you know, I mean, it was crazy stuff. And so, yeah, there were the moments where, well, the answer is a little bit more complicated, actually, because I never had a doubt that I will or we will figure this out. I never had a doubt that, so there is an answer, you know. I'm a martial artist. I get up, you know, you have to kill me. If you don't, I will keep getting up and keep fighting, you know. So that's my work and life philosophy, you know. So I knew that there's no way. There's no way that I give up. There's no way that I let this fail or fall, or, you know, and the same way I never had a doubt that we will be successful, even though I came from a country that, you know, was communist at the time, didn't have passports, didn't speak English yet. I had an absolute belief that I'm going to do this, right? So the same, I never doubted it. And then the same way, I knew that there's a way. With that said, I also thought, man, this can hit the wall any moment without any warning, where it will crash and I have to pick up the pieces, and I'm 100% sure that I can rebuild it. But it can hit the wall, which it did a few times, obviously. You know, it highly publicized when things went sideways, you know, it was out in the open. But look, that's what makes it a rock band. This is not a corporate entity and with the rules and regulations, and, you know, things can happen, you know.
but I have to say that I'm truly impressed by the band, because every other band would have canceled shows with the lead singer not being able to perform. Mm-hmm. You dragged in another singer.
Right.
And I was just like, wow, that's really impressive. And that's just one of the things that made Five Finger Death Punch, the yeah, the will to survive. Power,
yes,
guess.
Exactly. That the want to survive, and again, this idea that the band is bigger than any of us, you know. And even though when we had the problem in America the first time, and Ivan, we knew, I mean, he could have finished that tour, but we just didn't want to risk it. We thought like, okay, you're gonna die, and we don't know when, and we don't. And this is too much, you know. He was at the point drinking on a level that we knew that anything can happen, and we're not willing to put up with that risk. You have to go to rehab. There's no way out of this, you know. And so when Phil from All That Remains jumped in, first and foremost, Ivan and Phil are very close friends, you know. So those two are friends for 20-something years. And, you know, and the whole idea was that, well, there are going to be a lot of disappointed fans. There are going to be a lot of pissed-off promoters. And it's a whole chaos and ticket returns. And, I mean, it's a catastrophe, really. Both, you know, financially and just general of the stance of the band. So we were like, well, he has to go to rehab and we will finish this tour. So Phil jumped in. And what happened, interestingly, I thought that would happen, and thank God I was right. The fans looked at it like, okay, we knew. We all see he's falling. We all see he's falling apart. And we don't want him to die. And I'm talking about not just the band, the entire fan base. And everybody thought like, yeah, that was the right move. Put him in. We won the show. So they thanked us like, thank you for finishing it. Thank you for bringing it in Phil and do that tour and finish that tour. So we got a show. Didn't cancel it, but you did the right thing, putting him in rehab. So that was the, so even from the fans, we got this warm, you know, helping hand, sort of like, yes, you guys did the right thing. And then he was sober for a while, and then he fell one more time, you know, and we were in Europe. So same thing, we did the same thing, like, okay, well, let's Tommy had to jump in, finish six shows, you know, and the same thing, we were like, hey, you have to go back. You have to go back to rehab. And then the last time when he went to rehab, it wasn't a pressure from us. It wasn't a pressure from, you know, the situation from the band. He came to us. He was sober for a while and maybe like about 6 months. And then we finished the tour in December and he told us like, hey, New Year's coming up, Christmas, people are partying, you know, I'm not comfortable. I'm worried. And I really like to be sober. I like how I feel now, you know. And I don't want to jeopardize this. I'm going to go to rehab myself. So there was no pressure from the band or anyone else, right? And he checked in. And that was the moment for me and probably the rest of the guys that we knew, like, okay, I think he's going to make it. Because now he wants it. He likes to be sober. He likes to be clear-headed. So now he's fighting for that, right? And then we were, you know, so we were visiting him, you know, all the time, and you know, so then it became a really a group effort, like, okay, now he wants it, so let's give him whatever it takes, whatever he needs, so he can make it. And so that time he came out and he never went back. That's it. He was sober and also reborn in some way, and it's amazing to see him as a different person, totally different person. And and he's going to be okay. And it also gave us as a group, because, you know, this is without him, it's not the same. And it's just not even really interesting to me without him, you know. But now we have another, whatever, 10 years. So haters out there, you're getting another 10 records.
But all those problems that have been through the years, I guess those are also the things that shapes the bands and forms the bands and also strengthens the band. So have this been important to put on the record? I mean, does this influence the way that you wrote the stuff for the record?
Oh, yeah, 100%. Especially lyrically. Yeah. I mean, lyrically, this entire record is really about the places he's been mentally and physically. And, you know, this band always wrote about actual stuff, so meaning actual stuff that are socially or personally relevant right now. You know, let's say, you know, I like the history of the Vikings, you know, and there are bands who are singing about that, right? And I love those bands. But this band, it's not what we do. This is about, it's always been the personal journey, what we see around us right now, what's happening in the world right now. And that connects to everyone. Because there are some people are interested in history or, you know, or whatever our subject I would, you know, but it's a smaller segment than be talking about actual things that happens today and things that you might go through physically, emotionally in your life, right? And so on this record, it's pretty much all the, you know, the hope when he was almost, and then the crash when he didn't make it, and the, you know, all his emotions between wherever he was, the darkest days when he thought he's not going to make it, to the moment when he felt like he was on top of the world. You know, all these emotions are on the record. That's what lyrically this record is. And about the behavior of the people around him, some who abandoned, you know, and ran, some who stayed and tried to help, all those things. And what happens with those kind of lyrics, it's ambiguous enough that it can, that lyrics can be true for various situations. You know, if I said, this orange is orange. I made a statement you cannot, you know, take in any other way than what I just said. But if you write an ambiguous enough lyrics where, you know, it will mean something else to every single person, right? It makes sense, but it means something else. And it is really comes from emotions, then everybody understands, because either it's relevant to you or someone you know, right? And he's been always like that, but this record is very, even more vivid, if I can use that word, even more vivid how deep he goes and you know, talking about the things around him. So yes, the sobriety and he's getting sober, that whole journey is basically what's on the record lyrically.
So it's very, very personal. Will it be harder for Ivan to sing it live? I mean, if it gets so close?
Some songs he, like, it's an interesting question actually, because there are some songs from the past that he doesn't want to sing because he says, well, I was in a really dark place when I wrote that and I don't want to be there. I don't want to remember. It puts me back to the time when I was drinking and I don't want to be there, you know? So he has issues with songs from the past. These were written today when he was sober. So every single song that he wrote now, even though it's about the past, is from the perception or the perspective of a sober person. So he would not have an issue with that because he doesn't have to go to a drunk place. He has to go to a sober, even though he might be talking about the chaos, but still from a perspective of a sober person. You don't have to change hats. That's the issue with, you know, being in different places, that you wrote something from a specific perspective. And for you to repeat that, you have to go back to that. And that person who you were when you wrote that might be something you're not comfortable with. You know, here's an example. Everybody has done something in their life before that if you think about it, you kind of cringe. Like, oh, man. Like, you know, you're like, oh, I'm not comfortable with something I said or did. You know, everybody has that. We all did that. And an interesting thing about that, the fact that you cringe matters, because that means that you changed. Today you're a person who cannot accept that behavior. The fact that it makes you cringe tells you that, okay, I should make peace with this, because I shouldn't be cringing, because the fact that I'm cringing tells me that I would never do that again, or I cannot accept that person who has done, said, or whatever. That, you know what I mean? So that's one way for people to make peace with their past. But it also something, the reason I said that, because it kind of demonstrates that anybody who listens to this can feel that. Just think of one of those things that you did that makes you cringe. Now imagine if you have to go back there and repeat that all the time. That's how it would feel for him to, you know what I mean, to sing those songs. But now I'm talking about the things that makes you cringe maybe, but or you think about it, but you're a different person. So it will not affect you the same way. In fact, you can judge yourself now and say, okay, that was screwed up, but I would never do that again. I'm not that person. I wouldn't do that again or wouldn't say that stuff, right? So that's kind of how, you know, I could sort of explain what it means to him. And this record, obviously, as I said, he wrote it from a sober perspective. I don't, you know, he made peace with all those things. We're just talking about it, you know, as a, you know, he's explaining stuff, not living it.
So basically, this album is really more important.
It's heavy duty, yeah.
It's basically more important than your first album.
Oh yeah,
because this one actually means that you're getting on.
Right. Yeah, 100%. That's what I meant. Like, this will be a milestone. Like, we had important records, but this will be definitely a milestone where in the future we talk about a record, it will be probably one of those records that we, at least for us, you know, at least for us, it will be one of those, like, okay, that was a very important moment in our career. And just the fact that I can talk about it, it means that in my mind, we have a career. You know what I mean? 2 years ago, I could not even speak like this, because 2 years ago, I would be like, oh shit, today, you know what I mean? We'll see if we can put on a show. You know what I mean? That time is gone.
Let's get back to the recording of the album, because we have already talked about Charlie coming into the band, but how did that affect the way that you worked in the studio? That, I mean, obviously there was one way working with Jeremy and now Charlie coming in. Did that affect the workflow of Five Finger Death Punch?
No, not really. You know, it's you know, there's a every it's the same process, kind of. You know, everybody has their own studio. You know, everybody has their own studio, and we all kind of, we're not a jam band, you know, we don't get together and jam. That's not how we work. In fact, I mean, we don't even necessarily rehearse. You know, what happens, we all learn the songs, everybody's a pro, you know, we learn it, we know what has to happen, and pretty much we go on stage, sound check, go through it a couple of times, and, you know, that's the difference. You don't have to guess. Everybody's a pro. It's, you know, it's the same thing when session musicians have to jump into a situation. They have to learn it and go. There is no, you know, and you can't screw up. So we are in a fortunate situation. Like, everybody is sort of like that. We just, let's go. But when it comes to the writing, you know, we all have our home studios. And so you're writing riffs and ideas and you kind of flush it out, and then we bring it to the studio, and then especially the drums will be figured out. So it's not like the drum goes down first and then we record on that, right? So for example, I write a lot with drum loops. In fact, I use a lot of more hip hop and other kind of beats because it has a different vibe. So a different swing, you know, it's kind of grooves. So when I write guitar riffs on that, it feels different. If I wrote on straight rock beats, it will feel like that. And I like that it brings in an exotic kind of, and a groove that is not necessarily there in rock bands or especially metal bands. So I write those on let's say hip hop beats, and I knowingly, like, I bring it in a studio, and then we just take off the beats, and then the actual final beats will go on that. So a lot of like this thing, or Jason would program some stuff, and then, you know, we come to the studio, same thing, we wipe that off, and then we put in the drums, because the drums have to fit the song, right? And we are in the in quote business of we are songwriters. Right. I love Yngwie Malmsteen. I grew up all the shreddage. I love that. You know, it impresses me. You know, when I see shredding guitarists, let's say, or shredding drummers, I'm like, wow. You know, as a musician, I'm impressed. But most of the people are not guitarists and drummers. You know, so they just want to hear a song, right? And the Beatles, just to make an example, figured out how to write a song. Four chords, you know, and they're brilliant. Every song is different and it's just brilliant, right? So what happened there? Why? And then you start to look at this, the idea of songwriting. And the best, maybe the best example, bring up people who write scores. When you write a score for a movie, you know, if you're a little bit off, if the wrong vibe, it ruins the movie, right? So you have to accompany what's happening in a picture. You are narrating a movie, something that's happening. You're narrating basically with the music, right? Has to be the right vibe, the right speed, the right everything, right? So that tells me that you can speak with music. Or look at classical writers, Vivaldi, Four Seasons. I will play you any of the seasons, and you will know which season it is. How? See what I mean? How do you know?
Music is feelings.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
So that means that there is something else in us that you can communicate to with music. Because if I said, hey, here's a piece of music, what is it? And you say, oh, it's a soundtrack for probably a horror movie. Now, the question is, are you saying that because you saw so many horror movies that it's just natural thing, like, oh, that's the kind of music I saw in a horror movie? Or if you never seen a horror movie before, would you still feel that way? And I think you would. The same way that you will recognize the seasons without knowing which one. Yeah, right? So your body understands music, right? And as a songwriter, first and foremost, I have to talk to you that way, right? So I have to write music where, like classical songwriters, that they had to tell you a story without a vocalist, right? So the Beatles, four chords. Okay, let's talk about a four-chord song. Let's say I play you a guitar riff, and I will put a drum beat to the guitar riff that is a little bit lazy. The snare comes a little bit late, and it's just kind of, you know, shuffled beat. And you're going to have a feeling like, ah, this is kind of groovy, like kind of like, you know, kind of a chilled music, right? Same exact guitar riff. The drums are right on the beat, bam, bam, right? What happens? You're going to have a feeling of like, yeah, let's go, like almost a marching music. And then I'm going to make the snare a little bit too early, just a little bit. I'm talking about microseconds, but it just feels early. And that music will give you a sense of anxiety. So with the same guitar riff already, I gave you three different feelings, right? So when you're talking about songwriting, it's not as simple. So somebody's like, oh, that's a three-chord song or a four-chord song. Are you sure? Or maybe you just don't understand what actually happened there. Because I can create a musical journey by giving you a feeling of relax. I tense you up. I bring in drama. I make you anxious, and I drop you back again into, right? And at this point, you didn't hear a word yet. This is just the music. And this is just the rhythm. Now, let's color the chords. Let's color, you know, let's see what kind of, you know, harmonies and melodies and how they relate. And on top of that, you're going to put lyrics that if they're right, they will also explain what's happening. If it's all in sync, you get a song. Well, this is the thing. It's most musicians don't. That's why I say that writing a hit song, this you have to understand this. This is songwriting. This is not... If I sit here with my guitar 8 hours a day, yeah, I'll be a shredder. But that's not songwriting. I can impress you, but it's not songwriting. Songwriting is, this is what I just said, is this is the very basic. And you build from there, right? And so, and this is why, you know, a lot of people actually don't understand this. They say, wow, that's a simple song. And they don't realize, like, no, you just didn't understand what happened. You just don't understand what actually happened in that song. And songwriting itself is an art. And that's what we as a band go for. I would say musically, probably we're cruising on 30%, maybe 40% of what we could play, you know. But this is not about how many notes I can shove in and, or how many guitar solos. How Charlie could shred the hell out of that, you know what I mean, of that set. But why? Let's write a solid song. And the first three rows will have tears in their eyes. How do you get that? How do you take them to a place? How do I make you feel like I'm going to get up, I'm going to go to the gym, and I'm going to take on life? How do I make you feel that way? That is songwriting. That's what we are after.
A company always on the run. A destiny. Oh, it's the rising sun. I was born a shotgun in my hands. Behind the gun, I'll make my final stand. Yeah, and that's why they call me. Until the day I die.
A lot of heat. We get this band is pretty polarizing. We have a lot of fans, millions and millions of fans, and we have a lot of haters, right? And generally, we get it for unjust reasons, you know. Well, one way, because we're not conforming to the look of whatever they think a rock band should look like. We don't look like that. We don't, that's ridiculous. So now you're fashion policing me. That's, you know what I mean? That's you have a sorry ass life. Sorry. That's ridiculous. Second is, oh, these are, you know, like they, let's say they don't understand this. Like, why do we have 24, now 24 top 10 hits, you know? Most of them number ones and, you know, number two is number ones. These are big mainstream radio hits. How did that happen? 24 accident? No, I don't think so, right? So how did that happen? Because maybe we have an understanding of something. And, you know, so if you, some people maybe don't understand that. Right? My heroes are like Ennio Morricone and Hans Zimmer and people who are writing these massive scores. When you watch a movie and the score just gives you goosebumps, like this music just enhances this movie into, you know, that's how I write music. Like I see a picture in my head and I write a soundtrack to that picture, you know, and then I have a band who all are like that. They all understand this equation that we are writing songs here. How do I touch you? How do I give you a message before even Ivan wrote something on it?
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking of one score that really gives me goosebumps every time. And it was actually written by a guy who's not even a musician. Mm-hmm. It's the most simple score ever. The theme from Halloween.
Yeah.
That piano.
Right.
That's so simple, but
right.
It works.
Look.
Yeah.
I know exactly what I'm talking about.
It works.
Yeah. Yeah. Or Tubular Bells.
Yeah, Mike
right?
Oldfield.
What a tune. Holy cow.
Yeah. You could go on. the theme from Star Wars.
Right. The first, I mean, that was how big that was.
When you sit in the theater and the lights go down and the start screen comes up and the symphony occurs, like, doo-doo.
Right. You're there. Right. I used to watch a lot of, like, it's called spaghetti westerns, I guess. And Ennio Morricone was the guy. Oh my God! I mean, I would watch the movie just to listen to the songs.
There's a reason why Metallica used Ecstasy for Gold.
Yeah.
There's a reason for that. It's right. Because it works.
Right.
It's yeah.
Yeah. And there's a lot to learn from those guys because that is a very, very specific art form. I mean, Hans Zimmer, you know, he's one of the newer generation, but it's he did a lot of video games as well, you know.
Yes,
it's amazing. So, you know, it's a different art form. You got to study it.
Have you ever thought of going that way? I mean, Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails did it. So, have you ever thought of that?
Going to
to do scores?
To scores. You know, here's the thing with that. There are so much to do with this band. You know, it's still exploding. I mean, it's actually insane how it's still just going up. Every single thing that we do is bigger than what it was yesterday, you know? And it's so much thing to do. And I always look at it this way, that maybe they're going to be, I serve this band. This is my band. This is what I love to do. This is what I care about, you know? And these fans who are here, this is my life. This is what we became. This band is synonymous with who we are, what we do, you know, it's inseparable, and this will be your legacy. And there may be a time where let's take a break for 2 years, or, you know, or maybe we get to a point where we are too old to continue. I don't know. And then maybe that's the time, like, you know what, I write some books, maybe I score some music, you know. So, yeah, I'm interested, but I'm interested in so many things. You know what I mean? I'm interested in flying airplanes. I have 200 something hours. I just have to do my test. I still don't have a pilot license because I don't have the time to do the ground school. You know what I mean? I compete in jiu-jitsu and all kind of martial arts I'm doing. I mean, I paint, you know. I have so many, you know, things that I want to do. It's just this life is not, you know, not enough, you know. And so yeah, I would, it's on the wish list, but like a when and a how, this band comes always number one. This is when I wake up in the morning, this is the first thing I think of, you know, when I go to sleep with, okay, what do I have to do tomorrow for this, you know? And everything else, I just jam it in whenever I can, you know? And I get involved things that don't take too much of my time. Let's say I manage Fire from the Gods. It's an unbelievable band, actually. You gotta check it out. It's just that band can be a revolutionary band, revolutionary in a way that can change the industry or the music that we're listening to in some way. And Bad Wolves. And, you know, basically that's more like corrections, not 24/7, you know what I mean? They're hard workers. I wouldn't deal with a band that's not, because then you're not cut out for this. This is hard work, you know? So these guys are hard workers, and I can just adjust the steering wheel, like, hey, Tommy, no, don't do that. Let's go this way. And this is why. And he's like, oh, okay. And you know what I mean? But if I had to do everything, I couldn't do it. So I get involved with things when I can help. Like, okay, I can help you with this, I can help you with that, but I'm not going to do the work for you. You have to do the work. I just help you, you know? So those kind of things. And I just shove everything whenever, you know, I sleep 4 or 5 hours stop a day, and this is what it is. So I would love to, you know, but it's just one on the bucket list that one day might have time.
You have to seek advice by Bruce Dickinson. He does everything.
Right. He's a pilot too, yeah.
Yeah, and writes books and brew beer and whatever.
Right. He had a drone company, I think, he was investing into.
Yeah, kind of, and he had his own airline at some point. No, an aviation school.
Yeah.
At some point, so
bad. Yeah, he was a friend of mine in America, got a lessons from him. Didn't even know who's going to be his instructor. And he's like, oh my God, it's Bruce Dickinson was giving me a lesson. And, you know, I think he had to land in Catalan Islands, which is a pretty gnarly airport. I land there sometimes, and it's like, ooh, when you're approaching it, it's like, ooh, I can't make mistakes here. it's a low island, and the strip is as wide as the island. And it starts with like a 500-foot drop, before the runway and after the runway. So if you're too early, you crash. If you don't take off on time, you crash. It's gnarly.
And then there's the wind.
And there's the wind, right?
Wow. So will we ever see you flying the Five Finger Death Punch airplane around the world?
Probably not. Probably not. You know what? I don't think that these guys would, you know, sign up for that. There was an event when, you know, I was in a cockpit. We were flying over Iraq. And then we were flying into Iraq. We were playing some USO shows for the soldiers on the bases. And we were in a military transport, a C-130. I was in a cockpit with the pilots. And the guys were in the back, you know. And we were taking on some fire. Like, we were getting shot at. And so the pilots just dropped the plane out of the sky. So it was crazy. We were, you know, we were coming down hard. And everybody in the back started screaming, Zoltan, cut that shit out! You know, because they thought, like, oh, it must be me. It's a, you know, because they saw me doing some crazy stuff with, you know. And I don't think they would sign up for that. I don't think they would not, you know, no.
That's not part of the deal.
Yeah, they're like, no, not flying. I used to drive myself to school back in, you know, back in the days. And my into college, and my dormitory, I lived in a dorm, was an hour from the school, right, with public transportation in high traffic, right? And my dorm roommates, would take the bus. They were like, you're not getting into your car, dude. They know. Not a chance. I really used to drive like an idiot, you know.
So how about now?
No, I calm down. You know, I have much faster cars, yet I calm down. You know, I'm like, you know what, let's just, you know. I go out to the racetracks, that's different. That's controlled. It's if I screw up, it's all me. But in traffic, I stop being an idiot, you know.
So the new album is coming out in a month from now. And what is the next step in Five Finger Death Punch history?
So, I mean, on this record, we're probably going to be touring about 2 years. You know, this entire year is already booking up, you know. And we already like looking at dates, 2021. So I'm thinking this next 2 years will pretty much go away with supporting this record and touring. And I mean, we are almost booked up to the next summer, and we didn't even look at really Japan and Australia and South America yet. So it's maybe even longer, you know. And there is, you know, especially Japan, Australia, South America, we didn't really go that much. So those are markets. I don't even like to call them markets, but that's the those are places where there are a lot of fans. And we didn't really just, you know, we were so busy establishing ourselves here and in America. Because we had this idea of, you know, the way we did it, we really established ourselves in the USA first, right? Didn't want to spread thin. Even we were pounding that. I mean, we were touring and touring and touring. And once we had a good support, then we started to come to Europe, you know. Then we built this up. And then, you know, just kind of move smart. Because we have now, we have Europe and the USA that we can tour, and we will sell at arenas. And now we can start adding, you know, other stuff. And, you know, Russia, same thing, you know, Russia, Ukraine. So we start to go into the East. And I remember the first time we played there, man, we had like a small little club. I'm almost sure like a chicken ran across the stage in Ukraine, like a goat was outside or some crazy freaking stuff. And we played the sports arena for 6,000 people. And those kids know every word for every song, every guitar. So everything, they sing it, you know. And then we went to Moscow, same thing, you know, 6,000-7,000 people. So these are all, you know, built up now. And so if we start adding Japan, Australia, you know, then it's going to elongate these tours. But pretty much that's it. We're going to do that. And then probably 2022, you know, well, we'll go and do another record, you know. Generally we, because we do records as soon as we can, right? Probably on this one, it's going to be a little bit of a longer period of touring. But if anything, I would like to make videos. Because we were so busy that we never really, you know, either we're not in our videos or we just don't even make them because it's like we don't have time. We already on the road. Finish the record, in a day we finished the record, the next day we were already starting a tour. So, you know, the label is calling like, hey, we need a music video. I'm like, I don't know what to tell you. we are on the road. I don't, you know. So if anything, we would like to shoot some, you know, some more videos, some maybe at one point, possibly like a cartoon. A reason for that, because we wanted to do sort of a documentary, because it, the crazy stuff that happened would be probably entertaining. And well, for sure entertaining, because I have stories. Stories that you would believe. And some of these stories, you can't reenact it. So it could be a cartoon, because the, you know, it would be like Death Clock. It's very insane stuff. So maybe something like that would be interesting. That's a possibility that we invest some time in that.
And I guess that creates the perfect circle, because what we started talking about was hard work.
Yeah.
And this is definitely hard work. Solzhen, so much thank you for your time.
Absolutely.
And looking forward to the show.
Yeah, it's going to be 10,000 tonight.
Yeah. My Rock Podcast. Og så vidt ordene fra Solzhen Bathory, guitarist i Five Finger Death Punch. Jeg hedder Sten Skovgaard. Tusind tak, fordi du lyttede med. Og sidder du nu og tænker, at jeg kunne godt tænke mig at høre flere podcasts, så bare roligt, der er masser af dem. Du finder dem, hvor du fandt den her podcast, og så er du egentlig rimelig godt kørende, og hvis du ikke kan huske, hvor det var henne, så er det ind på radioplay.dk/myrock, der er der masser af podcast, eller i din podcast-app. Endnu en gang, tak fordi du lyttede med.
My Rock. My Rock. Podcast.